Now it's official. It has a name, coronaphobia. It's the fear of contracting the virus that causes COVID-19. And while a fear of contracting a potentially deadly disease is pretty normal in these times, excessive anxiety can lead to problems of its own. The National Center for Biotechnology Information describes coronaphobia as an excessive fear of contracting the virus, causing a person to do things like obsess over possible symptoms, seek out reassurance for doctors, and avoid all situations that could increase the chances for transmission. That may all sound familiar to a lot of us right now, but taken to an extreme, it could severely interfere with our ability to function. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had trouble drawing the line between a healthy respect for this illness and anxiety about it, where it is a constant presence in your life, you or someone close to you? Have you found coping mechanisms that you found helpful? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Kathleen Murphy Endy is a clinical psychologist at the UW Hospital and Clinics Department of Psychiatry. Her expertise includes health psychology and coping with medical conditions. She's also a nurse practitioner. Dr. Murphy Endy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, I appreciate the invitation to connect today.
Now, you work with people, even in normal times, who have concerns about health anxiety. What do we mean when we use a phrase like health anxiety?
Well, health anxiety is excessive or inappropriate anxiety about one's health based on misinterpretation of symptoms, for example, pain or digestive sensations. And they interpret these as indicating a serious illness. It's basically a less severe form of hypochondriasis or illness anxiety disorder, both of which are more of a psychological diagnostic problem.
How do we know where the line is between, with something like COVID-19, okay, this disease that we know is out there, it's pretty scary. Early on, especially, it was mysterious. We want to take it seriously. We don't want to end up in this place where the anxiety about the disease is also causing problems. How do we know where to draw that line?
Well, that's a very good question, because you're right. Most people are very concerned about, and rightfully so, about becoming ill or someone in their family becoming ill. But in, I think the key is when it gets to the point where one is preoccupied with getting a serious illness, of getting the COVID, having a high level of anxiety about it, and spending an excessive amount of time and behavior dedicated to this, is when really it gets to be more than just normal anxiety. Anxiety can actually be really a motivating factor for people. A little bit of fear is really normal and is actually a protective defense mechanism for one to be motivated to maintain healthy behaviors, such as masking and social distancing and washing their hands. But it really becomes problematic when a person is ruminating, spending an excessive amount of time on the internet, searching for answers, and where it's just preoccupying a lot of their time.
I wonder about, I've talked to people who have experienced depression pre-COVID, and the situation, the uncertainty now makes it worse. Is there something comparable going on for people who already were dealing with anxiety pre-COVID? I imagine this could just magnify stuff they're already dealing with, right?
Yes, it absolutely has. And I think part of the reason for that is because of the seriousness. People are more aware of the potential serious threats from infection than they were previously. And the length of the pandemic and the length of the social isolation has really added to people's angst. And so not having that social support that one used to have pre-pandemic, that social support serves as a buffer for any kind of stress. So many people really are suffering because of being isolated.
If somebody heard your description of health anxiety and says, wow, yeah, that's me. I'm feeling this right now. I'm engaging in some of these behaviors. Maybe if it's not at a point where they need professional help quickly, what kind of things can they work on their own or maybe with their friends to try to dial that down a little bit?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that people can do. I think the first step is really to accept that anxiety is a normal emotional response. And it's a protective mechanism. And so we do need a certain amount of anxiety to motivate ourselves to take action. But then what people can do is, and so I think that you're just recognizing that and validating that anxiety is a normal reaction, and then list your fears and ask how you can minimize the risk. So, for example, if somebody is really fearful of spreading infection to an elderly parent or friend, then wear a mask, distance, wash hands, limit visits, use phone or video instead. If there's a fear of side effects from vaccine, then talk to your nurse practitioner or your healthcare provider, employee health nurse, about specifically about what your concerns are. You know, confront what those concerns are. I think a very important thing now for many people to do is to avoid unofficial websites. So instead, look for information from trusted sites that hold themselves accountable for the information that they post. Sites such as Mayo Clinic, WebMD, National Institute of Health, those are just a few of several reputable sources that can provide you with accurate information. It's always important to consider the source from which you're obtaining and hearing information about COVID so that you can really sort out what is myth and what is really reality. And then I think people can periodically reassess their anxiety level and frustrations. And I think it's important to kind of tease out what is, you know, when are you feeling anxious and when are you feeling frustrated, and list those thoughts down and then ask yourself again, what can you do to minimize your risk and try to avoid catastrophic thoughts? And if you are going down that path, then, you know, identify it. It really can be challenging, though, to find a balance and not be immobilized by fear.
We're talking to Dr. Kathleen Murphy, ND, from UW's Hospital and Clinics Department of Psychiatry. She's talking to us about health anxiety in general and especially during the pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how to help someone who has this anxiety, who's feeling maybe excessively worried, overwhelmed by it during the pandemic? Is this you? Did you find a way to cope with it? Flipping things around, if you're a healthcare provider, is this something you've seen in your patients? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're looking at anxiety surrounding the coronavirus and how to keep ourselves from being overwhelmed by worries about our health. Dr. Kathleen Murphy, ND, is with us, clinical psychologist at the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics Department of Psychiatry. Time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions about health anxiety, your experiences with it as a person, a patient, or a provider. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Murphy, Andy, you were just talking about, you know, finding reliable websites in general for health things, COVID or otherwise. I think a lot of us might have had the experience of, I'll speak for myself. Here's a thing I have. Usually it's a minor thing that'll go away on its own. Rarely it's a lethal form of cancer. Which one has a much bigger web presence, even on the legitimate sites? Even with legitimate stuff, we have to be careful not to be overwhelmed by the most scary things out there, right?
Right. The power of suggestion can really stay with us.
So how do we start to, how do we sort that out and get that perspective as a layperson in particular as we start to search for these things?
Well, I think that's why it's really important to have a connection with your healthcare provider, that you can either electronically MyChart them or call the clinic to express your concerns. Because I think having that trusting relationship and knowing that you can ask questions, healthcare providers, you know, we don't expect that people are going to be able to read information necessarily and understand it and not jump to conclusions. And it really can be scary. It's not unusual for people in training to be reading about symptoms and then kind of suddenly wonder themselves if they have these illnesses. So I think people first should just, you know, not be afraid or embarrassed when they are feeling anxious about something so that they can get valid reassurance.
Another angle I understand you work with. You work with patients who do have very dangerous diseases and who, understandably, along with that physical ailment, might be dealing with mental health concerns related to that. When we have that diagnosis that maybe we've been fearing, what are some ways we can make sure we take care of our mental health as best we can?
Well, I think that's really a very important point to make. I think the individual has to really look at what are the things that add to their anxiety and what are the things that help them relax. It's different for everyone. I think that, you know, really if people are finding that their anxiety is so high that they need to self-medicate and that they're using substances to cope with the anxiety, well, that would be a sign that it might be time to get help. If someone develops symptoms of panic attack, palpitations, sweating, shortness of breath, you know, physical symptoms, then again, that would be a sign that their anxiety has gotten a bit out of control. Again, that excessive worry or rumination about health, sleep disturbance, excessive fear of doing normal tasks because of that. I mean, it really can negatively impact quality of life. So it's important to recognize it early and figure out ways that you can put your fears into perspective.
Let's bring on a caller. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I think part of it was, like with Trump, you didn't want people to see him or taking pictures of him wearing a mask. And I think some people are probably thinking that they look wimpy or something like that if they're wearing a mask. So I just wondering, well, how can we get the message through? This isn't about appearance. This is about looking smart. This is about being just being responsible for people's health.
Dennis, thanks for the call. A different side of the health psychology here, Dr. Murphy, and taking it seriously enough and getting rid over maybe some of our anxiety about looking silly in a mask, which I'll admit it took me a while, about a year ago today.
Mm-hmm. I don't really have an answer for that. I, you know, at a previous talk, we really discussed what were people's fears with, you know, getting tested or wearing a mask. I really think it's something that if somebody really has that concern, then they really have to put the concerns of others first, which is protecting others, you know, as well as themselves. But those really, really take precedence over just the fear of looking unusual. And I guess reminding yourself that probably nobody is really actually spending that much time looking at you or considering what you look like. I think we could all benefit from that reminder that really no one is looking at us under the microscope.
Thanks for the call. And Dr. Murphy, Andy, as we wrap up, briefly, a quick thought for, again, that person out there thinking, I'm on the edge of that anxiety beyond what I need to be, a quick thought for them as we wrap up.
I think that recognizing that is important because anxiety can grow, and so we're really all about early detection and prevention. And so if you are feeling angst or anxiety at a high level, then I think it's really important to reach out to a mental health provider. That's what they're there for. They deal with this every day, and particularly now over the past year. So you're definitely not alone, and they can work with you short-term, teach you simple techniques to get that anxiety under bay.
We'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Kathleen Murphy-Endy is a clinical psychologist at the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics Department of Psychiatry. She's a nurse practitioner as well. She talked to us how people can deal with excessive worry and anxiety about COVID-19. Coming up on Food Friday, a Wisconsin baking expert joins the show to share ways to avoid some common mistakes and answer your questions about what's going wrong when a baked dessert doesn't quite turn out. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Taking a dessert out of the oven is one of the small joys of life, unless it comes out looking or tasting not quite like we had hoped. On this week's edition of Food Friday, a baking expert joins us to help us troubleshoot our baking mistakes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had something come out of the oven not looking or tasting like you hoped? You're wondering what might have gone wrong? Are there some desserts you have trouble getting right? Is there a secret or tip that you have to share that's helped you avoid mistakes in your baking? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Punky Egan is a former instructor and director of the baking program at Madison College. She's a certified master baker, the co-author of 3 cookbooks, and she's on Instagram at Punky Bakes. Punky, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, hi, Rob. I actually think this segment should be called, uh-oh, what happened? There are lots of things that can go wrong, but hopefully today we can solve some of those and make baking much more enjoyable and not so much of a tense situation. I know when things don't turn out, people get very disappointed. So let's see if we can fix those mistakes.
Definitely. And I've made some of these kind of mistakes. You've taught a lot of people now over the years. What are some of the most common pratfalls you've encountered that trip people up?
Well, I could write a book about that. And I have made many myself, so I would have to include myself in there. I think for home baking, though, I would say number one is to kind of ditch your measuring cups and to get a scale. A lot of mistakes happen with especially flour, because that's the main ingredient just about everything we make. And if you're trying to measure out, say, 2 cups of flour, somebody might pack it down, somebody might sift it up. You never know exactly what that recipe is asking about. So if you have a scale and it says you need 8 ounces of flour, 8 ounces is going to be 8 ounces no matter how you put it in that bowl. So I would really encourage people to get a scale and start using it, and I think you'll be much more accurate with your measurements.
Another small purchase that I know you recommend, and I'll be honest, I still haven't, and I know I should, the oven thermometer, because all ovens yes. are not created equal. 350 on mine might be way off of 350 on yours.
Oh, and you know what? Even the very expensive ovens can, over time, start to waver a little bit on the temperature. So I find just a little oven thermometer you get at the hardware store will save you a lot of grief. And even preheating your oven, a lot of ovens will say, oh, it's at 350. But if you're looking at your thermometer in there and it's still not up to 350, then you have to wait a little longer. So a lot of mistakes will happen with your oven temperature. So I think if you get that little oven thermometer, that can help out a whole lot.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Steve is with us in Madison. Steve, hi.
Yeah, the problem is with apple crisp. You bake it for an hour at 350. The mix has equal portions, basically, of oatmeal, flour, sugar, and then you fold the soft butter into that. Sometimes the crisp sets up crisp, sometimes it doesn't.
I'm right there with you, Steve. This is my most commonly made dessert myself because it's easy and I'm lazy. But sometimes the crisp ain't so crisp, Punky.
Okay. Well, Steve, it could depend on the type of apples you use. If some apples are juicier than others, that can set up a situation where it can make the crust of the crisp a little soggy on top. So that would be one consideration. Also, I would probably, an hour seems like an awfully long time to bake that crisp. Is it in a really deep pan that you're making it in?
2 inches.
2 inches. I would probably maybe not fill it so full. Because again, that the longer it bakes, the more juice the apples release, and the apples almost become mush for that long a time that it's baking. So maybe if you can have it in a little thinner layer and maybe up your temperature 10 degrees, it should take about 35 to 45 minutes to bake that crisp.
All right,
so
Steve.
Steve,
sometime we can have a crisp off when things are back to normal and see who can make a better apple crisp. Let's go to Polly now in Wauwatosa. Polly, hi.
Hi. Yeah, years ago I wanted to make a special cheesecake for my mother's birthday, and a friend had a recipe from Lindy's in New York, and I made it and served it, and it tasted wonderful, but it looked like cream soup. It was just like laying flat, oozing out of the pan. And I went back to my friend and we were going over the recipe and everything was the same. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, maybe you didn't bake it long enough. And I said, bake it? I put it in the refrigerator.
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
Polly, thanks for sharing that.
Well, refrigerator.
I mean, that's a thing. I know there's no make cheesecakes, but I think the general lesson there that Polly might share is read the recipe first, the whole thing. And I've burned myself by not doing that before, Punky.
Yes, all the way through. And then you make sure that you have all the ingredients you need, too. You don't want to get halfway through and then realize, uh-oh, I don't have chocolate chips. So, yes.
Well, thanks for sharing that story with us.
That's pretty funny, Polly.
Definitely. Thanks for sharing that story with us. Now, how about, I know you have some butter preferences, Punky, for our baking. And again, not all ovens are created equal. Not all butters are created equal for our dessert baking.
Well, right. And, you know, you think here in Wisconsin, we would know butter. I mean, we do. But I find that the European style butters are really superior when you're making pastries, like puff pastry or tart dough, pie dough. And what that European style means is that there's more fat in your butter. And the easy way to know that is you just look at the label, and the general label will say 11 grams of fat per serving. And now the European will say 12 grams of fat per serving. And, you know, we know butter has milk solids and it has liquids in it and besides the fat. So the more fat that you have, the more it behaves differently, more plastic. I'll use that term plasticity, but that's the term you'd use, that it makes your dough more pliable and it doesn't let off so much moisture. Now, you don't need it for everything. You don't need it for your cookies, although once I have it, I use it everywhere anyway. But I would check the label, even though it says European style, sometimes it still isn't. So if you find where it says 12 grams of fat per serving, that's what you want. And then you also do want an unsalted butter. Because then
talking
you can
Punky
control
Egan.
The salt.
Sorry, we're talking to Punky Egan on this week's edition of Food Friday, baking instructor, longtime baking instructor, solving some of our baking problems. Now, let's talk about how we mix things. When can we do stuff by hand? When do we want to definitely break out a little extra power to mix our ingredients together in baking?
Well, if you can't get to the gym, you can just take your old spoon and bowl and away you go and you'll have your workout. But if you're not looking for that, I would probably say when you're trying to do heavier doughs, that's really hard to mix by hand, although you could. Let's say chocolate chip cookies. And all of a sudden you want to double the recipe. That mixing, that creaming part of it, the sugar and the butter, that's really difficult to get really creamed. So you'd want a mixer. And you can use just a hand mixer. You don't need a stand mixer, although you can make more in a stand mixer. But again, that's a tool that you don't necessarily have to have. I want to encourage people to bake, and I don't want them to think, well, I need all of this equipment before I can even start making a cake. So I would encourage people to start, you know, just mixing things by hand. A little hand mixer will work well. Even a whisk, if you're whipping up egg whites, you can whip up egg whites with just a hand whisk. Takes a while, but you can do it.
Let's bring on another caller now. We've got Jessica on the line in Plymouth. Jessica, hi.
Hi. I tend to have trouble with my springform cheesecakes, the water getting into them when I'm doing a water bath, and I've tried wrapping in tinfoil, but nothing seems to help me.
How old is your pan? It might be the fact that it has some little dents in it and the water's seeping through there. You can try it by just putting it in the sink and see once, you know, and hold it up with some water in it to see if you're having leakage around.
Okay.
So that would be one option.
Might be time to get some new gear, Punky.
Gadgets, yes. Or what you can do, are you lining it with graham cracker crust, or what type of crust do you have?
No, it's a sponge.
A cake. Okay. All right. And are you going up the edges at all?
No,
the cake?
It's very flat on the bottom.
Okay. If you can get some of that sponge, it's a sponge cake, I'm assuming, right?
It's a sponge crust with a cheesecake on top.
Right, but if you can get that sponge bottom up the edges, that will make a seal also.
All right. I love it. Using the sponge as a spackle, Jessica. That helps.
Right.
One of those two bits of advice. Okay, let's finish up, Punky. Talk about mindset. If we do make a mistake, it doesn't turn out like we wanted, I don't know, how can we convince ourselves to bounce back, fix the mistake, and try it again next time?
Well, you know, it sounds nerdy, but I always keep notes when I bake. So that if you do make a mistake, you'll know enough not to do that same thing next time. Or you can just enjoy it. I mean, everything, baking pretty much, unless you're adding maybe too much salt or you're just totally burnt something, a lot of our mistakes are still edible. So I would just enjoy them and just kind of make notes for next time and think, all right, I better change something on my recipe.
All right. Punky, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome, Rob, and happy baking.
Thanks. That's Punky Egan, former director of the baking program at Madison College. You can find her on Instagram at Punky Bakes and find some of her recipes at punkybakes.com. She joined us for Food Friday to talk about how to avoid some common baking mistakes. You can still share your baking disaster stories, if you'd like, with pictures, if there are pictures, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.